I am going to record the share.
I'm happy for people. Don't post it on the internet because we don't know what's going to be said yet. So we'll work out at the end whether we're posting or not posting. So we'll see. It's very exciting to be in a salon. I've not been speaking in a salon before, really. And walking up the very French staircase in the front of the building and having this kind of revolutionary atmosphere where we can sit and talk about issues and then change the world, it makes me feel a little bit younger than I am, but nevertheless I suppose it's never too late to be revolutionary. It's definitely a very important topic to get a little bit of focus and perspective on. I've got to thank Shayna really, or whoever came up with the topic. I know it's an obvious topic to talk about now, in some ways actually not, because it's a little bit emotional, and maybe emotional is not the right time to talk about a topic. But I've never really looked into all the sources on this before, and I still haven't looked into all the sources. It's an incredibly large topic, this issue of appropriate ethics and halakhic and hashgafic perspectives on dealing with civilians in war. There's a vast amount written about it. I was able to, you know, put together a relatively short source sheet compared to what could be, and it's still 10 pages long. My apologies for the length, and thanks for copying it. But what I have done was, I'll tell you at the very beginning, is I've given you at the end of the sheet, on page 9, I've given you a suggested further reading list. There's a good 1,000 pages of reading on that suggested reading list, if you're interested in it. I can't claim to have read every page of those 1,000 pages, but there's a lot of different perspectives there as well, all coming from a Jewish Orthodox perspective, but I think there's a range there. So we can talk a little bit more about that at the end if there's any time. What I want to do is really speak for about 30 minutes. Is that what you wanted, Shayna?
Yeah,
about 30 minutes? To give a bit of background. I'm not going to go through every source on the sheet. And then we can have a discussion on these issues. Let me tell you what I'm not going to do. I'm not here to talk about politics. I don't think you need to hear my political perspective. I don't have that many, quite frankly. And certainly I'm not here to try and suggest political solutions. I'm not here to talk about military or security issues. I have no expertise whatsoever in those. You can bring someone else to talk about that. I'm not really even here to talk about, although we can discuss it, how to deal hashgafically, if you like, from different perspectives on how to deal with the current situation. The current situation is not new, it's just new manifestations of an old situation. That's not really what this topic is dealing with. What I'm really here to do is to learn Torah. I think learning Torah is a good response to anything, quite frankly, and certainly to what's going on right now. And to look at this, the issue of how to develop an ethics of war, and where to look from Jewish sources, in a way which at the same time protects us, achieves our goals nationally, militarily, but at the same time separates us from the rest or the others, or makes us keep a sense of moral perspective that we don't feel that other people have. And I think, obviously, we can't always claim the moral high ground, and I wouldn't suggest that we always can. But I think what we find is we find people coming at us at the moment, and perhaps always, with a lot of hate, with a lot of rage, with a lot of what, from our perspective, seems to be not very thought through sort of reactions. And I think the response to that has to be the opposite. And when I mean the opposite, I don't mean that we should approach it with love and compassion and a big sort of fuzzy-wuzzy kind of feeling, although there's a place for that too in life. When I mean the opposite, I mean the opposite of rage and anger, meaning thought through and focused. And if we think about it and try to understand it and work it through, and come to the decision, having done that, that we have to kill people, then that's what we have to do. But it has to have been a thought through situation. I think that Golda Meir's famous quote, that we can forgive the Arabs for killing our sons but not for turning our sons into killers, is completely wrong. I think it's completely incorrect, because it gives the impression that what the Arabs have done is turned our sons into some kind of murderers, or made them cross a moral line that they shouldn't have crossed. And I think that's just incorrect and naive. Everybody has to understand that in the world forever, in the human condition, and in the modern world as well, you sometimes have to fight other people to uphold the values that you hold dear. Everybody has to do that. They always have, and frankly they always will, until Birat HaMashiach, and there's a whole, and even that'll be a lot of fighting till we get there. So the idea that you're not prepared to kill people in order to uphold your morals is, or standards in society is naive, and has never been. And all of us come from societies where, which have and are prepared to kill America and England and the Western world and everywhere in order to achieve what they have to achieve. But it has to be thought through and there has to be some guidance. So, I'm not here to give the ultimate answer by any means, but I'd like to talk about a few issues. First of all, it's challenging to find these issues because we have new national social issues that didn't present themselves in our classic system. Meaning we have a halachic system which has been developing for the last 2,000 years, which has been very prati, which has been very specific and individual. It's very hard to open the Shulchan Aruch and find answers to questions on a klali basis, which is what these questions are. And we may be able to find them there, we may be able to find them in other places like that, but we may have to look to other sources to find those answers, and the question is where. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And also it's very hard to deal with these issues today when we haven't got a full range of halachic solutions available. By the way, this is not just a military issue. You could raise this issue on the question of gerus, on conversion, on the issue of agunot. Meaning we don't have a Sanhedrin. We're meant to have a Sanhedrin. That's how the halachic system is meant to work. With a Sanhedrin, there's an awful lot that we could do. And we hope that we'll get one, and we hope it won't be long. But we don't have one now, which limits our halachic solutions to some degree, and it's frustrating. And that frustration manifests itself in other religious debates, not just this one, but it's an important one to bear in mind. But we have to work with what we've got. We can't pretend that we are living in a messianic era when we're not. And therefore, with the tools that we have to do what we can do. Now, let me start with a perspective, I think, on shalom, which I think is very interesting. Because at the end of the day, whatever we decide ethically in terms of the necessity of killing military, killing civilians, is always going to be from a perspective of shalom. It's never going to be from a perspective of war. Have a look at source number one. There's a beautiful midrash that says, V'zot Torah Devach HaShlamim. It talks about shalom. And it brings the pasuk, Desha Katsuk, Darcheha Darche Noam Bekon Sivateha Shalom. What does it mean when it says in Mishlei that all the paths of Torah are peace? So let's read this. I'm not going to translate every word. I assume most people here speak pretty good Hebrew anyway, and if you don't, then we should, all of us. So I'll translate, you know, most things when I read. It says, Kol Masha Katsuk HaTorah L'Shem Shalom Nichtav. Everything, please, sexy. Everything in the Torah is written with a focus on peace. Even though it says in the Torah that we have to sometimes kill, even the killing has to be done with a view to peace. HaKadosh Baruch Hu changed the Torah because of shalom. And look at what it says here. But Shasham HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, when Moshe is told by God, Ki Tatsur Iru El Iru Yamim Rabim, when you go against a city for in a siege, what happens? So Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sheyachrim Asa. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu that these towns, these people, he has to fight with. He has to wipe them out. He has to destroy the towns. Shneimar Ki Hachrim Tzachrimen. UMoshe Lo Asa Ken. But Moshe didn't follow the instructions. Ela Amar, he said, Achshav Ani Holech UMakem Michata UMishelochata. This is an amazing thing. Moshe says, is it possible that God would want me to kill innocent people? God says, wipe them all out. How can I wipe them all out? How can you kill people who did nothing wrong? I'm going to go to them with shalom, at least to start with. Shneimar, v'shlach malachim b'midarek imos, divrei shalom le'rab etzach. So he sends messengers of shalom. I'd like to make peace with you if I can, and I don't want to have to fight. Once he found out that he wasn't being met with peace, he came. So he fought, and he killed them, and he had to kill them. Etc. Then God responds and says, "Ani amarati kecharim tichrimam. I told them to wipe them out, and you refused to wipe them out." God says to him, "You know what? You're right. I'm going to change my perspective." Amazing language. If you say that, Ani Yoseh, I'm going to do that too. And then God brings into the Torah a mitzvah, Kitikrav and Ir Ilachem, when you go to a city to make war, Aleh against it, Ukarata El Hashem. It's an incredible thing that God, according to the Medrash, is responding to Moshe's intuitive unwillingness to kill someone who is not guilty with a mitzvah saying, okay, you're right. Approach the Mishalom if you can. And I think as an override, and he brings the Racheha, the Rachinoam, the Kolatim, the Mishalom. I think as an overriding perspective, this is critical. Because even when we have to take steps that we don't want to take, it has to be from a perspective that we're not trying to kill for the sake of war. We don't believe in war. But whether it's war or holy war, Rav Soloveitchik was very quick to say, Milchemet Mitzvah is Milchama for the purpose of achieving a mitzvah. The war is not the mitzvah. The Milchama is not the mitzvah. It's a Milchama in order to achieve what has to be done as a mitzvah. Which is an important point, which I think we have to bear. I just wanted to make that as an opening comment. In terms of sources of halakha, this is a general point. It's very interesting. Where are we going to look? So we can look to the classic codes. And one of the questions we're going to have to raise tonight is, do we get the ethics and halakha of how to deal with people who attack us? Do we get them from an individual scenario? Meaning, there are halakhic systems such as rodef. If somebody is chasing after somebody else, if somebody is about to kill another innocent person, we can kill the killer. We must kill the killer. Is that where we're going to learn these halakha from? Or Hababa Mahteret, somebody who comes in the night and breaks into this person's house. The Torah says you're allowed to respond with force. We can assume if they broke into our house in the middle of the night that they're going to want to fight. And therefore you're allowed to kill them before they kill you. Can you just take that idea and expand it onto a nation? And say, when we deal with the enemies that we have today, with the Arab world, if it's going to fight us, it's based on Roydim, or it's based on Abba Mahteret? Or do we say, no, actually, this is different. War is different. And we'll see that there are different perspectives on this. Maybe war is different. Maybe we need to look for other sources. It's not just a million individuals, but it's actually a different entity. And country versus country is going to be different kind of perspectives. Of course, then you have to define who is a country and who is an individual, which is very difficult. When we fought Syria in the Six-Day War, it's clear, the country, the state of Israel versus the state of Syria. When we fight people in the street who attack us, are we fighting a country? Are we fighting a movement? Are we fighting individuals? I have no answer to that question. But we'll see that it may make a big difference. Where else can we look? There are sources in the Rambam, which are broader, that deal with war as a whole. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't deal with wars, because it's a practical guide to how to live Jewish life. They didn't need to have halakhas in wars in Krakow in the 15th century. Jews didn't have power to fight wars. The Rambam has a broader perspective. Broader than that, there's Tanakh. Can we look to Tanakh as a source for how to deal ethically with wars? Hello, let's take a seat. Find a short sheet. Have some food. And I'm going to give you some examples in Tanakh of where we might look for that. Also, what about broader than Tanakh? Can you look at Jewish wars that we fought in the past? Josephus, the wars of the Jews. Can you look at the Maccabees, Sefer Maccabees, and bring Jewish war ethics from there? Rav Gorin was quite controversial in suggesting that actually these can also be halachic sources, even though they're not halachic works. This can be a way to instruct the Jewish army how to work. Maybe there are no Jewish sources for how to fight wars. Maybe it's basically a Dina de Malchus Dina type arrangement where the law of the land is the law. So just like the way I drive the car in America or in Israel is based on the law of the state rather than some halakhic system. Maybe the way I fight a war is based on the Geneva Convention. And the Geneva Convention halakhically means as practiced by other nations, not as technically stated in a book and used, selectively against other people. That's actually a principle of Dina Mahostina. If there are laws on the books which nobody keeps and everybody does something different, then are they really laws? So too, in international relations, if there are standards that only Israel is held to, but everywhere else in the world they can do that with impunity, what does that mean? And we all know what I'm referring to. And then there is, of course, a view that all wars are osa, we shouldn't be fighting, we shouldn't have a state at all, we should be just waiting for Mashiach, and the whole thing is wrong anyway. Obviously, the whole shir is over if you take that view, but you should be aware, it's a view. It's a view that some people hold. I have been told by people, and they've been told by teachers, we'd be better off if we were under the Ottomans which is fine, except there are no Ottomans anymore. And the people who were under the Ottomans are now no longer. So we're still dealing with the problems of the First World War.
ISIS.
Yeah, they are the new Ottomans. They're the latest replacement for the Ottoman Empire. Fine. Now, let's have a look at some sources. I'm not going to go into all the sources, but I'm going to point out what things say, and you can read it later. How do we deal with proportionality when it comes to killing? Can you ever justify killing a larger number of people to protect a smaller number of people? That's an interesting question. We'll deal with that as we go along. We'll see with individuals it may be different from with a war scenario. The situation of Roida is enshrined in the halakha.
Where do you get that question?
Where do I get the question?
The question was that based on?
You can't, generally speaking, kill one person to protect another person in halakha, on an individual basis. If someone says kill him in order to save him, okay, I can't kill him to save him. I certainly can't kill 15 people to save one person. But maybe with a war it's different. Maybe there are different factors that play in when it comes to a war scenario where the normal rules of I can't kill one person to save another, maybe they don't apply the same way.
Yeah, this whole idea that war is the rules of war,
right, so we'll
might
see that.
Be just a composite of all these different laws about killing, such as Rodef and all these things.
Or they might not be, they may be something different.
Well, it seems to me pretty obvious that it's not. It's Moshe told to fight a war against all these people. He wasn't telling them to count the number of people.
I understand, but that doesn't mean that every war that we fight is the same war that Moshe fought against the Malek, etc. There are different kinds of wars, and we'll see that. Roedef deals with goes like this. Number two, the Elohim Shemasidim Otom Benafsham. There are certain people that you can protect by killing the aggressor. Okay, Haroedef Achachaveru Lahargo. Obviously, someone who is chasing someone to kill them. Okay, Achadoka VaAchanara Hamusura HaHamurasa. Or somebody who is chasing after a man or a woman to rape them. Which is interesting, because that itself, you might think, is a lack of proportionality. That you can kill somebody to stop a rape. So the halakha says, no, actually that's totally acceptable, because a rape is seen to be on the same level as a murder. And there's a whole discussion that comes out of the psukim there in Devarim. But you can kill a person to stop them from killing another person. That's very clear. By the way, the person who's about to do the killing might not even be guilty. They may not even be aware of their killing. Roedef applies any time an innocent person is about to be killed, even by a non-aggressor, such as possibly an unborn child. One of the justifications for being able to carry out abortions under certain circumstances is that the baby is classified as a roedef, even though the baby obviously has no malicious or criminal intent. It is harming the life of the mother and has to be stopped before the mother is hurt, if that's the scenario. Or let's take the scenario of a hunter mistakenly aiming their rifle, thinking it's at an animal, but it's actually a person. So you can kill the hunter to prevent the person being killed, even though the hunter's not a criminal. Roedef kicks in. However, the main issue with Roedef that comes up here is it's based on the concept of proportionality. Look at number three. I think the Rambam was a pick up on one halakha of the Rambam. Haroedef achachaveru laharga. Afilo haya haroedef katan. Even if the roedef is a child, as I said. Everybody has to save the person, the victim. Miyat haroedef from the roedef. Afilo benafsho yishal haroedef. Even if you have to kill the roedef. So that says the Rambam. Caveman, how's that work? Imedi ru v'hari ru roedef acharab. If you warn the roedef and he's still chasing after them, if you can warn the roedef. Afo pisha loy kibol ala vatra. Even if he doesn't accept the warning. Caveman sha adayin ru roedef. If he's still chasing after them, hari zen neraga. He has to be killed. But if you can save them, if you can stop the roedef by something short of killing them, by shooting them in the leg, kagoyim shiyaka atov ached, smack them with an arrow or something, or the edm with a stone, or the sand with a sword, kitavat yada, or cut off their hand, or you shabra et es raglav, or break their leg, or you sam et enam, or blind them in the eye, only thing you have to do that. And the Rambam goes on to say that if you could stop the roedef, but instead you can't be bothered. His language is v'loy tarach b'kach, and you kill them when you could have stopped them without killing them. You yourself are a murderer, which is interesting. So there is quite a high level of proportionality which is imposed on the case of the roedef. You can't just kill people unless you feel that's the only way to stop them from doing what they're about to do.
The Jews and non-Jews.
Yeah. Absolutely. In terms of a Jew killing a Jew or a Jew killing a non-Jew, there's no distinction. Absolutely. What the din would be for non-Jews to kill other people, I'm not getting into that. Okay, so you're protecting a Jew here. I don't know what you're asking. Are you asking, are you the person you're killing is a Jew or a Jew? No. If the person who is being attacked is a Jew, then it makes the difference whether the person attacking them is a Jew or a non-Jew. Okay? If the person who is being attacked is a non-Jew, he doesn't deal with that. He does that separately in Hilchos Malachim, where he deals with the halachas of non-Jew. It says Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. There's a whole different system at work here. But since we're really focusing on the people, the victims on the whole, being Jews, although in the case of civilian casualties in war, we're often not. It's often non-Jews that we're killing. The question is, we're killing them to save Jews in Israel. That's what we're talking about. So the question of how Rodin comes in is relevant. However, the case of Hababa Machteret, which is in number 4, so the Pasuk in Shemot, which says, if you kill someone who is in your house at night because you think they may harm you, there is a hetzer to kill them, and there is no requirement of proportionality, which is interesting. The Rambam says in number 5, I'm not going to go through it all now, that even unless you're absolutely sure that they're not going to kill you, that you can kill them straight out. The case of absolutely sure being so extreme is the case of something like us. You find that the father is the aggressor against the son. There's no way the father is going to kill the son. By the way, the son against the son might still kill the father. But the father against the son, never. But unless you're absolutely sure, says the Rambam, there is a hetzer to kill people. Therefore, in terms of self-defense, and again, the war scenario, in terms of the classic question, there is someone firing a missile from a building in Gaza, and that missile is aimed at a kibbutz in Israel. And in order to take out the missile, they have to bomb the building, and thereby may kill a large number of civilians. Okay? Which is a separate question we're going to get to a little bit later. In terms of Roideth and Hababa Machteret, it's very clear here that with Hababa Machteret anyway, that if a person feels that there is any danger at all to their life, they're able to kill them. The question is, are they going to be able to kill a large number of other people at the same time? That's going to be the question. I wanted to bring out Roideth and Hababa Machteret because they are the two classic examples on an individual level of saving your own life by killing somebody else or saving somebody else's life. The cases which are coming up halachically, again, I'm not giving any kind of halachic guidance today at all, but there's no question that if, God forbid, a person lunges at another person with a knife, then they are halachically obligated to save themselves or to save other people.
They have to be warned, right?
So the issue of roideth will say that if you can warn the person, then you must. The issue of Hababa Machteret doesn't even mention warning. And I'm not getting into now a lack of comparison between the two. Where are the differences between the two? Hababa Machteret seems to be much more of a personal self-defense issue. Somebody is rising up against me. Whereas Roideth is much more of a, I can see somebody chasing somebody else. That's more the focus of it, but they overlap more than that as well. Which is interesting. Because the Roideth case demands a certain proportionality, warning, and if I can stop them some other way, etc. Hababa Machteret says, if my life is going to be in danger, I can end it unless I'm absolutely sure that there's no danger. Which is interesting. Because in most of the cases we've seen recently, people cannot say that they're absolutely sure there's no danger. In most cases. Although, of course, every case is different.
Coming to steal property. It's not coming to kill.
Right.
But there was a rationale for why he's nevertheless endangering your life.
Right. And therefore, any time...
You're going to assume you're going to kill him.
But I don't know why. I don't know what he might do. He's London. He's in my...
But there's a rationale.
Correct. Because if I think...
It's almost like an inevitable outcome.
Not inevitable, but it's a possible
outcome. You're saying that he is going to assume that you're going to kill him.
He's going to assume I'm going to defend my property, and if I defend my property, he's going to, with a weapon, and he's going to be prepared to come against me. But it's nothing certain, that's the point. I'm not certain. Maybe he's not. Nevertheless.
When you're certain that he's not,
when you're certain that he's not, then you can't. Okay, but once you think that he may, then you can. The question is, does any of this have any real application in a war, like I said before? It's important to know Roideth and Hababa Machteret are the two classic individual cases. But the war scenario may be different. If you flip over to page 3, I want to show you a few interesting examples.
See, a war has a limit factor involved, and that is strategy.
Right. Meaning,
it's not just an individual, you know, scenario.
Correct.
Where meaning, one life is measured against the other, it's a strategy.
It's collective.
Yeah, it's, if, you're,
is
this, yeah.
If it's possible, we totally are going to have a discussion at the end.
Oh, okay.
So.
She's the boss. If she says so, then I'm happy.
No, it's part of the program, I promise.
You've got to get with the program. Okay, so let's see if we can look at some wartime scenarios that might help us a little bit, because Roydip and Ababa Makhteret may apply more on the street, but they don't really help us so much with the kind of strategy, like you correctly say, should I take out this facility and thereby maybe kill these people in order to potentially protect against or a long-term war effort. So, there are a few cases in Tanakh that you can look to that may indicate certain ways forward. I've brought you 5 or 6 of them. First of all, there's Yaakov's encounter with Esau's 400 men. Remember the story, Parshas Vayishlach? So Esau is coming, he's brought 400 men, and Yaakov is afraid. Look at number 6. But you write Yaakov, Yaakov is very afraid, against the Lord, and he's afraid. Classic Rashi, why are they afraid and afraid? So Rashi says, at the end, Vayera Shema Yarei, he's afraid maybe he's going to get killed. Vayetalai, he's upset. In Yarogu Etachirim, maybe he's going to have to kill other people. So everybody's getting excited, all the Meforshim. Why are they afraid if you have to kill other people? There are 400 big angry men coming at him to kill him. So he's going to have to kill other people. Why is it something that upset him? So some people want to say, yeah, that's the whole point. He's allowed to kill them. He's not happy that he has to kill them. But okay. So others don't take the view. The Maharal has an interesting position. He says in number 7, basically.
Also, the relatives.
The 400 men are not relatives. The 400 men are just hired hands, the hired guns. That Asaph's mob that's coming to check. Asaph's the relative. And there are people who say that he's worried he might have to kill Asaph, which is the point, it's going to upset his father. So the Maharal says an interesting thing. He says he's worried he might kill these 400 men because. How does he know if all of these men are going to come kill him? Maybe they're not all in it to kill him. Maybe some of them have just been drafted, forced by Esau to come along. Maybe some of them are there because they're scared, because Esau's going to do something to them. How does he know, says the Maharal, that he's allowed to kill each individual one of these men? Which is interesting. Do you need to know? Do you need to know who's angry and aggressive? It seems from the Maharal, maybe you do need to know. Because he's frightened, he's going to kill someone unacceptably. Others take a different view. The Mizrahi number 8 says, no. Of course he's allowed to kill them, they're coming to kill him. What he's afraid of is he's going to end up killing Esau and Yitzchak's going to get upset. That's what he's afraid of. Different abortions say different things. But Yaakov and the 400 men is definitely a key source. Shimon and Levi is the main source. Remember the story of Shimon and Levi? So Yaakov, is now living with his, with his sons. Dina gets abducted, raped, and kidnapped. Shem sends a message saying, I want to marry your daughter, and Yaakov doesn't know what to do. Shimon and Levi go through the whole subterfuge, the psukim are there, number 9. Yeah, you'll have a bris milah, you'll join with us, etc. And it's all a big scam. They go in, they kill everybody, they kill Shem, they kill Hamor, who are the guilty parties, and they kill all the men in the town. They come back, pick it up in Chafzai. Okay. Bnei Yaakov ba'u l'chalalim, v'yavozav ha'ir asher timu l'chotam. They despoil the city, they take all the money. V'etzonam v'etzbakaram v'etchamoreihem v'etasher ba'ir. They completely lay waste to the city. V'etkol chelam v'etkol tapam, they take all the children, they don't kill them, they take them. V'etnasheihem and the women, shavu, they take them all as the slaves, v'yavoizu, et kol ha'shev ha'bayit. And they just basically despoil it. V'yom ha'yakov v'shimu v'lel levi. Acharatim uti la'av v'sheni v'yoshev ha'aretz. How could you do this? You've made me think in the eyes of the people. Forgive the next metaphor. That's how he says it. Okay, the kanani v'prizi. And he matay mitfar. I'm a small number of people. This is a disaster now. Is he making a moral point or is he making a practical point? It's a good question. The next for Allah, everyone's going to gather and kill me, the Nishmadati and the Ubaiti, and I'll be wiped out. And the sons answer, by Yomer, and they say, Shimon and Levi, Hakazoni Yaseh Bachatayim. So what, you want them to treat our sister like a zona? That we want? They can just take our women and just do what they like? And Yaakov doesn't answer. So what's the last word? Who's right? So it's unclear. He leaves this question mark. Now you might say that Yaakov gives the last word because when he gives the brachas to Shimon and Levi, he turns around and he says, how could you do what you did? But it's not so straightforward. And there are three basic approaches. First of all, it's not so straightforward what Yaakov's talking about. Yeah, maybe he's talking about Yosef. There's a big machlokes in the Mefarshim whether Yaakov ever knew what the brothers did to Yosef or not. But there are three basic approaches in the Mefarshim about the Shimon and Levi. The Rambam says an interesting thing. Again, I leave you to read the sources more. I just want to give you an overview. The Rambam in number 11 says, how could, look at number 11, Kesad Mitzavim Haim Aladim. How are the non-Jewish world commanded to keep laws? They have to appoint the rule of law, each town and judges, etc. And at the end he says, that's why all the men of Shechem were liable to be killed. Because Shechem was a kidnapper. The Hebrew, when they saw, the Yadon, they knew it. But why didn't they? They didn't bring him to justice. Therefore, all the civilians who were killed were themselves guilty. Because they should have brought Shechem to justice. So the Rambam says, how could Shechem kill, how could Shimon and Levi kill the men? You cannot kill innocent civilians, but they weren't innocent. They were innocent. They were liable. That's his position. The Rambam, in 12, 13 and 14, says, no. They were out of order. They were wrong. Yaakov says they were wrong. And the civilians were innocent. What could they have possibly done to stop Shechem? Let's get real. How could they have really stopped him? And Shimon and Levi were wrong for going there. That's the Rambam position. The Maharal, which is the most often quoted one at the bottom here, says a very interesting thing. The Maharal says, you know something? They were innocent. And they couldn't do anything to stop their leaders. First of all, it's not democratically elected leadership. You're talking about small fiefdoms and tribal leaders. They don't get asked whether they want these leaders. But says the Maharal, you know what? The same Maharal that said that Yaakov was worried about killing Esau's 400 men, maybe they weren't out to kill him. The Maharal says, you know, in a war it's different. Why? Look what he says, picking up in the second paragraph. We don't like Hashemim. First of all, he asks, how could you blame the civilians for not deposing Shechem? There's nothing they could do. We should delight Dami Shnei Umos. It's not the same when you have two nations. Could go B'nai Yisrael and Canaanim, like the B'nai Yisrael and Canaanim. We're now in national war scenarios. The Pikach Chutzalahem L'Lilchom. They're allowed to carry out war. Kidin Uma Sheba L'Lilchom Al Uma Acheret. As one nation against another, Shehit Hira Torah. The Torah says that's acceptable under certain circumstances. The Afar Gavdek Amra Torah, he says, even the Torah says you have to try and make peace. If they won't make peace, you can't make peace, etc. Therefore, the Maharal lays down a principle that in a war, innocent civilians will end up being killed as part of the war effort, and that is regrettable but halakhically legitimate, when necessary. And he brings that from Shechem and the whole case there. Obviously, we'll see later when they discuss it, they're not talking about deliberately targeting innocent civilians, but they're talking about killing innocent civilians as part of a military operation. And there's a lot more to talk about, but this Maharal is very much one of the founding positions of the modern debate as to is it or is it not legitimate to kill civilians as a secondary, what they rather upsettingly call collateral damage of the military operation. Yes?
In this case specifically, I mean, because if you said that the civilians were allowed to be killed because Shimon and Levi were not attacking Erodes,
he said maybe he was a Erodes because he was repeatedly going to keep her and possibly rape her again. But that only applies to Shechem. It doesn't apply to the other 100,000 people in the town. 100,000 people in the town. They're not Erodes on any level.
Right.
Indirectly or directly.
What I mean is that if two nations are at war, I understand the question, can or should civilians be killed? So what legitimizes the war itself? What happens if one nation just
goes off with another? Good. So we'll see soon. There are two separate questions. What legitimizes the war, and what conduct is legitimate in that war?
Right.
Okay? And they have to be dealt with separately. There are different categories of war. The Chemet Mitzvah, not Chemet Rishut, we'll see. So we'll see in the Chemet Mitzvah, which is really what we're talking about now, is a justifiable war. whether Shimon and Levi was or wasn't or not, well, justifiable or what, is part of the Mephoshim discussion. Rabban holds definitely not. Let me just point out another couple of cases, and then I'll bring you some modern day voices. First of all, be aware, this is an example that my son pointed out to me. David and Abigail, if you look in number 16, so David wants to kill Abigail, well, kill Nabal, because Nabal has upset David, he's refused him help, he's refused him cooperation, so he says, that's what we'll kill him, he's moirid b'malchus, he's rebelling against my authority, and Abigail comes along and says, why do you want that stain on your record? You don't want that, even though you're justified, you don't want to kill these innocent people. And David says, you know something, you're right, you stopped me from killing innocent people, it was the right thing to do, etc. And therefore you can analyse that story, who was right, was David right to have killed them, was David right to have been stopped from killing them, etc. So that's one episode. Yeshua and the Givonim is very interesting, because the Givonim trick Yeshua into making a treaty, and they should really be punished, but they turn around and say, what's world opinion going to say? If we make a treaty with these people, albeit that they tricked us, and then we killed them. Therefore, it's an interesting debate about how Chilul Hashem. I brought you there the email then that says that they were worried about Chilul Hashem. So obviously Chilul Hashem is a factor in the way that we do things, even if we're in the right. Maybe there are things that are appropriate, technically, but are not appropriate because of the bigger perspective. Again, I've got no easy answers to that. To what extent do you suffer losses because of Chilul Hashem? I don't know the answer to that question. A rocket is launched from a building that could have been stopped, but wasn't stopped because of what would the world say? Does that justify? It's a good question. And finally, the issue of David. David is stopped from building the Beit HaMikdash because he said he has blood on his hands. What do you mean blood on his hands? What he did was justifiable. He was not a murderer. Okay, the Bathsheba, Uriah, there's a big question mark over that. But that's not the blood that Hashem's talking about. It's talking about that you've killed many nations. What does he say? Shofech dam ha'adam. No, not that, sorry. Where am I? Number 19. Vehi alav dvar Hashem lemor, dam l'roiv shafachta. You've still so much blood. U'milchamot gedolot asita. This is not Uriah. This is the whole campaign. Lot ibn Abish. You can't build a Baitul Shem. So the redactor says that even though the civilians he killed were justifiable, given the military scenario, nevertheless, he's not the person to build the Mizbeach, he's not the person to build the Beit HaMikdash. So there is an example of a justifiable scenario of killing civilians, but nevertheless, it's something which does leave an impact. Let me bring you a few modern voices which I need you need to be aware of. First of all, the Netziv in number 22. The Netziv, who is a Rosh Shiva of Elazar, he brings on the Parshas Noach that we just read last week on the prohibition of murder. So there in the Pasuk it says, if a person murders, miyad ish achiv et rosh et nefesh ha'adam, I will claim that from his brother. If a brother murders a brother, kind hevel type scenario. Says in the Netziv, okay, that's when you're in a brother scenario. When you're in a war scenario, where there's no brotherhood going on at all, then the laws of murder just don't apply. And it's very interesting, the laws of murder don't apply, the laws of risk don't apply. Later on in the sheet, I brought you a tshuva of the Tzitz Eliezer, who was asked, is an Israeli soldier obliged to risk his life, and maybe multiple soldiers to risk their lives to rescue an injured comrade or somebody who is in danger? Now, normally speaking, I'm not required to risk my life to save other people. Like Samad or Dabriyacha, I have to help save other people, but I don't have to jump into a raging torrent when I don't have to swim in the vague hope that I might be able to save someone. I just don't have to do that. I'm exempt. So the Tzitz Eliezer, that doesn't apply in war at all. He says many soldiers have to risk their lives in order to bring back another soldier. Why? Because you're not talking about individuals anymore, you're talking about collective units. And the army works together. And therefore, the individuals, his language is very strong, a person has to forget that they're an individual. They work as a unit now, and what is needed for the unit is what is necessary. On the other hand, I was only following orders. It's not a valid defense. There has to come a point when the individual has to step back from the unit and say, you've just asked me to do something which is indefensible, I'm not going to do it. And you'll see soon Rav Lichtenstein talks about that specifically. I hope you don't mind, I'm just giving you an overview, because obviously I don't want to keep you here all night. In number 24 is a shaila that was sent to Rav Avram Shapira. Rav Avram Shapira was the Yerosh Hashiva of Mecca the Rav, and also the chief rabbi of Israel from 83 to 93. He was asked here in number 24, have a look here, about Tohar HaNeshek, military ethics. Ma dina shel uchrusin, oh yeah, of an enemy civilian population, ezrachim, ba'et milchama. Ha'im yesh mitzad adin heta lifgoa ba, amanat limnoa pegia. Straight question. Can you bomb a civilian target in order to save lives? So he said, kol od eisa kanama mashit l'chayaleinu. Unless there is a real danger to our soldiers, ain heta lifgoa ba nefesh, there is no heta to attack anybody, af lo baruchosh, not even property. It's very, very clear that there is no halakhic justification for hurting or killing or even taking property from anyone unless there it is justifiable on the basis of saving life. Because if it's not, then you can't do it. Ulam, nevertheless, ka'asheh ha'sakana hi muchashit, when there is a real, tangible, establishable danger, harishiyesh liskor she'al kol mazlam, and then he talks about the idea that everything has to be weighed up. And he says it's not just a proportional numerical weight. He said you can't just measure one life against one life and say, well, I can save 10, I can kill 10 to save 20, but I can't kill 30 to save 20. He says that's not how it works. Because again, the normal rules of individual self-defense or attack or whatever don't apply in a war. He says it has to be gauged in a more overview kind of military way. How he doesn't get into it, obviously it's a military decision, but he says you can't just bring a numerical proportionality about that. I brought number 25, Rav Shoni Israeli, who was the founder of Eretz Chemda. He also legitimates a military target which includes civilians. Again, you can read his exact language. The Pesukim in Yechezkel in 26 talk about warning civilians. Yechezkel says if civilians are warned but they do not leave, then they bear responsibility for their own fate, which is interesting because we also warn civilian populations in many scenarios before we go in and do things, and that comes coming straight out. Shmuel there, and also the Yechezkel also say for Shmuel when it talks about the Kaini. Interesting, number 28, Rabbi Victor Amiel, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, was asked by the Haganah. The Haganah had a policy of what they called Havlagah, which is they tried not to attack Arab targets. And Rabbi Amiel wrote a piece that said he was unhappy with the Haganah not killing Arabs just because of their policy of restraint. He says the reason you can't kill Arabs is because they're human beings. You can't kill Arabs. And he look at what he says, number 28. Choshveni shemamarim haniskan le'el midvarim ba'adam she'amnam hineni mitnaged la'Hashem hablaga. I don't like your expression restraint. She'zenu mashma, that sounds ki'ilu kol isa shel shpich adamim shel arabim, the whole issue of not killing Arab people is who rakni fada hablaga. It's just because of your policy. Meaning, if you didn't have that policy, then you would kill people. He says, how can that be? Surely you can't kill people because the Ten Commandments say you're not allowed to kill people. Okay, there's no worse ethical corruption, if you like. If we can justify murder, we can't start getting utilitarian about our justification of murder. This is acceptable. Look at this. Even if we could say with certainty that we would merit the Geula Shalema, the ultimate redemption, by killing people inappropriately, we don't want that kind of Geula. We don't want a Geula that requires us to compromise fundamental ethical principles. And he says, and not only that, he says at the end, even if we're able to capture certain Arab murderers, אך אם יהיה לנו אפילו ספק אחד מאלה שבתוך אלה אולי נמצא אחד נקי, even if we're one in a thousand chance that there are innocent people with the murderers, עלינו לבלי נגוע בהם, we're not allowed to kill the murderers, שמה על ידי כך יסבור גם הנקי, in case we kill innocent others. Now what he said, and how does that deal with what we said before? So there's a long article in number 29, there's only two lines from it by Rob Neri and Gutel, who analyzes this, and he comes to the conclusion that halachically it is valid to target civilians, to target military targets, but if that involves civilian casualties as well, not target civilians, clearly. And he talks about Rav Emil Tzak being one of more of an individual Tzak. It was individuals against individuals rather than nations against nations, which really raises the question, in what way was the Haganah's action against Arabs in 1938 different from the Israeli army action against Palestinians today, or it's clearly different from the Israeli army action against Syrian army action, but how do you work out when a civilian issue becomes a national issue? And these are not easy issues, and you can't just ignore the comments of Rav Amiel there about the issue of not killing people when they are actually human beings, clearly, and we cannot kill people. The last two things I want to bring your attention to is really as follows. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in source number 33, has a piece where he talks a lot about the ethical dilemmas. And as you'd expect from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, he gives a very balanced, complex, and nuanced approach. He says, look, a milchemic mitzvah, and most people are classifying what we're fighting, what we have been fighting for the last 70 years is a milchemic mitzvah, meaning it's not a milchama to expand the boundaries of Israel for personal conquest of the king or anything like that. You can look at that. It's a milchama to protect the Jewish yeshuv in Israel. So let's assume it's a milchemic mitzvah. Says Rav Lichtenstein, there's a cost. There's a cost for war. There's a cost to our own soldiers, which has to be weighed. And Sheinit, he says, I just wanted to bring it here, there's also a cost on how many of the enemy we have to kill. That's also a factor, he says. Because the enemy is also a tzelem elokim. So we can't lose sight of that. That when HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creatures are dying, even if we have to kill them, that's a cost. It's not something we do in anger or rage or delight. It's something we do even though it's a cost. He says there has to be some proportionality in numbers. You can't just ignore numbers. What if we could save one Israeli soldier by killing 1,000 civilians in Gaza? Is that legitimate or not? Now, I don't know where you're going to draw that line. And everyone's going to draw a line in a different place. And Rav Aaron doesn't say he knows where to draw the line. He says, but there has to be some limit. You'll see other people say no. Any number of people are justified when it comes to saving an Israeli soldier. Rav Aaron says, no, not necessarily. There has to be a weighing up of that cost of the enemy's life as well, and that line has to be drawn somewhere. And he says, over the page as well, on the top of page 8, he says, you can't just leave that decision to technocrats. Excuse me, my voice is a bit strained, but it's doing all right so far. I'll finish in a couple of minutes and then let you do the talking.
We can't leave the decision.
To technocrats, look what he says. He says, the first line of page 8, Amnon, Elo ein tamid yod'im listok b'shar shehudan b'halacha. The Posek doesn't always know exactly all the details of the scenario. Ulam asur lo, it's prohibited for a halachic authority, v'lanu faz, lehistater tahayin ma'achore yaban shal hayyadanim b'hatechnokratim. We can't just turn around and say, there's something the military know what they're doing. So that's not an acceptable position. Because there has to be some ethical, moral bound to what the military is doing. We can't allow the military to make all those decisions themselves, by definition. But Lomar, we can't just say, Shakol Yed Amasi, it's a Vetla. They know what they're doing. He doesn't suggest what we should do, but he says that we can't do necessarily. And he says, the last paragraph in bold, Olam Chashuv Biyoter, it's the most important thing to understand. Sheha'adam Ayotel in Milchama, that if a person goes to fight, Yeidah, he should know. She'ein hu Overmi Olam Baal sulam arachim echad. He doesn't go from one moral value system, lo olam baal sulam arachim shone, to a completely different moral value system. There still is a moral value system which applies to all these scenarios. Now it may adjust in war because of the different realities, but it can't just be ignored. And 34 is a piece from Rabbi Yor, which is more hardline, more, if you like, you might call it the right wing, but I don't think that expression is very good, really. And he says, at the end of the day, protection of our own soldiers and civilians has to be on the highest rung of priority. He said clearly, no civilians may be targeted unless there's a legitimate military target as part of that whole thing. And you can read how he says it and how he puts it, and he brings from the Maharal, etc. But he says it quite strongly. I just maybe leave you with two last comments. I've gone a bit longer than half an hour, I'm sorry. But just two comments from two different people we haven't heard from at all. I brought you just a one line. I didn't have these in the original Hebrew. In 36, Professor Arthur Kasher, who is a grandson of Rav Menachem Kasher, actually, who is also the author of the IDS Ethical Code of Conduct, he's a very well-known professor of philosophy in Israel, he says there, as part of his whole thing, obviously you have to see the whole thing in context, we've no moral obligation to risk the lives of our soldiers in the context of military operations of self-defense against the enemy. But on the same by the same token, I wanted to bring Rav Goren, who is often seen as one of the more, if you like, hardline voices, who ends, and he says there, human life is undoubtedly a supreme value in Judaism as expressed both in the halakha and the prophetic ethic. This refers not only to Jews, and this is the point we were making at L before, but to all men created in the image of God. We see that God has compassion for the life of idolaters and find it difficult to destroy them, stone by Amoran next week in the parasha, etc. Since we are all enjoined to imitate the moral qualities of God, we too should not rejoice, and this is where I started, this is where I finished, over the destruction of the enemies of Israel. There's no firing guns in the air and rejoicing and handing out candies. There's none of that. We have to kill people because we have to. And it's necessary, and it doesn't turn us into murderers, if it's done in the appropriate way, whatever that is. But it's something that has to be done in a thought through and analytical way by the relevant people. And there have to be checks and balances. Where they are is not clear. But hopefully there are guidelines from Tanakh. There are guidelines from the classic sources. There are guidelines from the other places that we've seen. And, you know, this is not going to give clear answers. But there are answers. I brought you on the last page, just in case you're interested, the protocol, the additional protocol to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which deals with civilian losses in a military scenario, and accepts the legitimacy of civilian losses as ancillary to a legitimate military target, delineates those, limits those, puts certain checks and balances in place as to when that's appropriate or not. But again, we all know that in the real world, the Geneva Convention is also a large political game, and it's hard to separate the moral and the ethics from the politics in the real world. So, did I answer anything? No. But the I didn't set out to answer anything. Apart from, I think, the first thing and the last thing that I said, which is, I don't think that we should feel that defending ourselves, even if it requires us to kill other people, is somehow not part of the human condition. I think it sadly is part of the human condition. We have to accept responsibility for that and deal with it properly. Which is easy for us to say sitting in a room, but, you know, we are all chayalim on a certain level. That's what's become clear over the last few days. People are chayalim, it doesn't matter whether they're in an army base or whether they're in a bus station in Beersheba. People are chayalim fighting with guns or fighting with selfie things. And, you know, you can do a lot of damage with an unconventional weapon. Well, I don't mean a nuclear weapon. I mean a selfie stick, kind of unconventional weapon. And this is, you know, one has to think about this. Where people do not overstep the bounds and act in rage and anger, you see what happened last night in the bus station where an innocent man was killed. And I understand why people did that, but that it comes from the kind of anxiety, and part of what we have to try and do in this whole scenario is kind of decrease the anxiety level, which is hard to do, so that decisions can be made properly by the right people in the right way. I think part of, just in my personal opinion, part of decreasing the anxiety level of the general population is listening to the news less. That's just my personal pet peeve. Sarah will tell me that I'm very annoying about it. But I think that people increase and feed their anxiety by constantly and constantly. Can you imagine the Second World War having been fought, where every military operation was being followed on Facebook by every relative of every person? Just imagine that for a second. I just don't think it can happen that way. Okay, I've said quite enough. I hope that was of some interest on some level.
Thank you.
Yes, Josh.
I'm just curious as to how relevant these discussions become when you're in the heat of battle, because it seems that, you know, when I haven't, thank God, I haven't been in a situation where my life has been threatened, but I have been through traumatic situations. So, like, anything that I'm about to say, call the former in a situation where you're fighting for your life. But my question is, are you even aware of this? You know, when you're in a situation like that, your primal instincts kick in, it's fight or flight, and it's... The last thing on earth that you're thinking about, is, or that even a part of you, I would assume, is pondering about the philosophical implications of...
First of all, I'm not the right person to answer, because you need to ask someone who's been in the scenario and who's dealt with it. You need to bring in an army person that talks about how to deal with that. But I'd say two things. First of all, when it comes to an individual fight or flight, that's a Baba Matzeret. Somebody breaks into your house, you open the door, there's a strange man standing there. You know, you don't have to make philosophical analysis. The halacha says you can shoot them if you think legitimately that there's a danger, that they might be a danger to your life. Obviously, you can't, someone stealing your cabbages at the other side of the field, you can't, you know, take out, you know, turn down my cabbages, then you're going to shoot them. That's not good. But in an individual circumstance, that in terms of national army maneuvers, the answer is the soldiers are not, in theory, making individual decisions in the heat of the moment. They receive training. That training is done in a thought-through way, not in the heat of the moment, and therefore, I'm not the right person to be saying this, because I've never been in the army. You need to bring someone who is. But my understanding is that when the officers are making decisions, and the soldiers carrying out those decisions, the decisions the officers are making are being thought through, not in the heat of the moment, taking into account these scenarios. Now, obviously, they're not sitting philosophizing in the middle of a war, but the philosophizing has been done, because the army has a philosophical code, in order to draw up what is and what isn't acceptable, and the officers putting that in place. So the philosophizing is being done. It has to be done. You don't just give weapons to the IDF and say, do what you think's right. It's a very tight system. And when you're on the level that my son is in the IDF, which is, you know, pick up gun, fire, and he's in training in Kabir, I think you'll pay to shoot, not to think. You know, he's not meant to be there to think, not pay at all. But, you know, the job of the individual soldier is just to do what the officers say. The officers are doing the thinking, you know, hopefully. Yes.
When you make a statement that we couldn't just, as citizens, just rely on the army to do their job, we needed to somehow step up to the plate and take some sort of interest or even action, it sounded like, from what you said.
Or release responsibility.
Responsibility, okay, but I would assume that they have a biblical leadership. You just said just now that they philosophically have thought.
Yes, I'm sure they definitely do.
The officers are trained to make correct decisions. So it's two different things. Either they are trained, and we can trust the training that they've been given. They have rabbinical advisors. I'm sure Palestine, they know how to teach the officers. So, you know, what kind of action can the regular citizen really take? Because it sounds like, I mean, they certainly know better than I do.
Yes, except that in the system of democracy that we have, don't we as individual citizens have some level of responsibility and choice on lots of issues? I mean, what do I know about economic policy? But someone puts a polling booth in my, you know, my, and I have to vote for this one or that one, having to make a decision. So I think what Rob Aaron was saying is, you can't just abdicate all responsibility as an individual citizen and say, I don't care what happens.
We exercise our responsibility.
We do by voting. voting and also by expressing ourselves. Now, I'm not saying that having a rally against the ethics of the IDF is at all appropriate.
Yeah, that's
God forbid. And we wouldn't do that, certainly not when the Israeli army is
not when all our kids are there.
That's not suggesting at all. All that Rav Aaron is saying, and again, our internal discussion as a nation will be different from our external discussion. All Rav Aaron is saying is that we can't just abdicate responsibility entirely, that's all. We can't just say, you know something, the minute one Jewish life is in danger, anything is appropriate. Now, he's not saying what's appropriate, but it's that you can't just say. Which I think is a reasonable statement. Now, how you express that guidance to Israel, that's a different question. And we have to, obviously, Ahdut is very critical, and there is a time and a place. And the time and place is not in the east of the back. Undermining the Israeli army is not what we're trying to do here. It's not what Rav Aaron's trying to do. Yes, sir.
There's often public debate, like the case of Gilad Shalit, for example, that over a period of 2 or 3 years, there was a lot of public debate as to what extent does the army go back for a soldier, or should more soldiers be put at risk in order to save the life of one hero. And there was a big, I felt, seismic shift in attitude towards whether a soldier is meant to go up for the life of the people, or whether the people are meant to give up their life of the soldier. That was a very big public debate, and that influenced a lot of politics while it was going on. It was a very big drawn-out thing. You obviously don't get the luxury of that much debate around most cases.
And it wasn't even necessarily a luxury. In many ways, I think it was detrimental. The amount of public debate maybe caused us to make decisions based on politics, which were not necessarily always the right decisions, but that's not the way to say. By the way, it works the other way around. At what point is it legitimate to kill your own soldiers in the interest of the bigger war effort? And that's an interesting question. Would it ever be legitimate, for example, to kill an injured soldier to prevent him from becoming a kidnap victim? Or my grandfather in the British Army in the middle of the war, he said when they were being evacuated from Dunkirk, and they had to form, I mean, the whole thing was a debacle, if you know the whole story there, but they had to send little, you know, boats in to pick up 350,000 British soldiers who were left stranded on the beach in France. It was a military disaster, which they then claimed was a military astounding victory. But anyway, so he said they were all standing on the beach, and they were told by the officers to wait for these boats to come and pick them up. But of course, and the Germans were strafing, the Messerschmitts were coming in and machine gunning the soldiers. But of course, the officers had to keep order, because otherwise there'd be a panic and everybody would die. So they said, we have to stand in line. And the minute a British officer broke ranks, broke ranks because he was scared, the British officer shot him. Mm-hmm. They said they shot their own soldiers to keep order, to save the lives of the majority of the soldiers. Now, how do you make that call? I don't know whether that would ever happen in the Israeli army. I can't say it does. But is that ever legitimate? And that's also a question. Yes?
Two things. The first question, you brought a few rabbis who are clearly identified with the right wing.
Yes. That's why I brought Rabbi Lichtenstein as well.
So do you personally feel as if because I think there are also rabbis further to the left.
Maybe. And I didn't look across the whole spectrum. Who are you thinking about?
I'm not thinking, well, I just don't see the net. In other words,
excuse me.
People who are like Mr. Bat Shalom, different sort of left wing religious mimad, you know what I mean? I was just curious about your process with that.
You're asking a good point. I haven't read the whole material. I don't claim to have read it. I'm not sure whether there are voices coming out of a stature. See, this is the people I've brought are of a stature, meaning anyone can have an opinion. Who cares about my opinion? And who cares about lots of people's opinions? But when somebody who is a senior Rosh Hashiva expresses an opinion, or see a Torah leader, that opinion carries weight as a Torah opinion. Therefore, the people I've brought are people like Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Lior, who are senior Torah leadership figures. Rav Gorin, etc., Rav Tetzeliezer at the end. Now, the question is, if there are other voices, and there are other voices, it's a difficulty in the modern world always as to weigh which voices should be heard amongst other voices. And I don't know the answer to that question. One of the difficulties we have in other areas of controversy and terror issues is that everybody's voice seems to have an equal, you know, volume, which is not correct, because you can't have that in any system. So it could be that there are people of the stature that we're talking about that have those more left opinions, but we need to see who they were, and we have to weigh them and see whether they're, you know, an op-ed in Haaretz in my opinion, is not a legitimate counterbalance to Rav Lichtenstein. I know that's maybe not what you're talking about, but we'd have to see who they were and who these voices really were.
All right, and the second thing I wanted to note was the question of lynches and people sort of shooting terrorists or other people on the site and things like that. There could be a number of factors. You said anxiety, of course, that's one of them, but I get the sense that people are just desensitized, that they're very desensitized to the value of human life. In a situation a possibility of like 2 seconds into being stabbed and whatever, people are just forget it. Human life.
What should they do?
So Pinchas acted in the moment. It doesn't sound like Pinchas sat and scratched his head for an hour and a half. It sounds much more, we don't know, it sounds much more like Pinchas. He saw something, and in he went, he was a Tanai, and he did what he did. And afterwards, Hashem gives him Brit Shalom. The question is, what is that Brit Shalom? So it could be that Hashem is giving him a reward, the Brit Shalom is a reward. But the Nesiv says the Brit Shalom was necessary to
calm him down.
No, because Pinchas had killed. He had murdered, and therefore he needed something.
He hadn't murdered, he killed.
Okay.
If he'd murdered, he would be a murderer and he would be liable as a murderer.
Okay, thank you for it. He had killed, he had blood on his hands, that's the same as on earth. And in order, because he was like destined to be a priest, so maybe just stand. Hashem gave him a kind of an antidote. Now, I think what I'm trying to say is as follows, like, a good halakha to throw in the voice also, which is, you said it yourself, we might be in situations where we have to kill people, but we don't want to do it gladly, we don't want to do it hastily, we want to think about it. And I'm adding a further thing, which is, and if we've already done it, and we've become a society, as Golda Meir said, that feels, you know, whatever, you object to that, but I think there was a point there.
Thanks.
What can be done to re-sensitize ourselves? Can that...
This is my personal opinion. I think you're overstating the case. I don't think the Israeli public, as a public, has become desensitized to human life. I just don't think that's happened. I think that in situations where people are stabbing or shooting other people, people are reacting, and from what I've seen, on the whole, are reacting appropriately. There's not a wholesale, you know, mob of people running around beating up Arabs around the street. That would be what I would see with a desensitization. And I think that just hasn't happened.
First of all, I saw a mob of 15 teens here.
There's always a mob of 15 teens.
Shouting Mother to Alabim and jumping on a taxi. I just want to say that. Jumping on a taxi, trying to open the doors and shouting Kamal Agilo. Now, either they wanted to get the Gilo, or they wanted to find out.
Kamal Agilo. It's just a negotiating position, Yael. It's just like an opening, you know.
Right.
If you're not the prize, then we'll stop. Look, I don't know.
And we see videos of mobs descending on the terrorists, or who they thought was a terrorist, which was an Eritrean, right?
Right.
And just mob, mob bloodthirsty.
Right, so I'm saying that can't be right. So we have to find some way of dealing with it in a non-mob way. We are fighting a mob. Therefore, we can't be a mob. So I'm agreeing with you. So what do you?
I'm just saying that should be out there. That while we're being attacked in this way, which is causing us, I've become more violent in the last week. It's causing us all to become more violent and desensitize us to violence. Each person, I think, is just like moving up a notch in terms of what.
They blame the Arabs for that too.
The Seder, but lots of people are, and I would in a different conversation perhaps. But what I'm talking about now is, how do we also look at this inside ourselves? How do we give ourselves a bridge shalom? How do we make sure?
Well, I think we do this. I think this is the answer. We look at Makorot and we think about it and we talk about it in a non-anxious and a non-heated environment. And if you can encourage people to debate on these issues, I think that's helpful. Public debate is helpful. That's what more can you? You can't tell people, you know, don't react, because they need to react. They need to be able to shoot somebody who's about to knife them.
What you can tell people is, protect yourself, by all means protect yourself, but let's never forget that we value human life.
Of course. I think that message has been coming out. I haven't heard anyone in positions of responsibility in this country anyway denigrate human life. I've, on the contrary, I'm not trying to defend the government. That's not my job here at all. But I've heard them say to people, let the authorities, let the security services deal with these issues. Don't take life and things into your own hands.
Right, I feel like the issue with Eritrea, the rebels was going to happen, basically was the locus for some of this stuff to really come out.
Yes.
Before that, people weren't shouting, okay, don't take the law into your hands. Like, whatever, as long as we get
right. Right.
And then here, you know, human life was lost because of the lack of. I'm not judging. Like,
I understand that. And we also need to be sensitive, but we don't need to be self-analytical to the degree that prevents us from doing what we need to do.
Yeah.
Meaning, the British are not very self-analytical about British airstrikes over ISIS and how many, who knows, civilians.
I mean, people don't really care about this Eritrean. I'm guessing that many people really.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know.
It's definitely not going to be
the
race
at the end. It was the same thing. They're going to arrest the people who did it.
Yeah, I know, but you know what? There's a lot of people.
You don't know who.
In many law kinds of international ethics.
Yeah, inappropriate.
It look good.
I bet you
that many people are sitting around going, you know, who cares about that? He's in the wrong place.
I don't know if you're projecting what you think they're thinking.
I know.
I don't know if they're thinking what you think.
Because their scene was chaotic.
You really don't think that many Israelis really don't give a crap about that.
People would care much more about that if the circumstances were different. If this guy was more maliciously murdered, then it would be different. I think people would feel a lot.
I read an interview with one of the guys that had been kicking him while he's down. He's like, I couldn't sleep that night when I found out he was innocent. I don't believe that it was malicious, brought on by anxiety and nervousness and everything that's been going on. I don't think it's an issue of a lack of desensitization of like what's been happening.
Okay.
What bothers me, and like believe me, I think we're on the same page with the whole death to the Arab marches, which I've also witnessed, not the same one that you did, I saw a different one. I've seen two different ones actually. One was like a year or two ago. My issue isn't like that violence is more acceptable. My issue is this, why is it more acceptable to say death to Arabs than it is to say let's not kill them all? And at least a lot of the circles
are standing.
I guess not, but it's like it seems that, you know, I like this quote someone said about you can't shift one ladder to a different one. I know it's from a war versus civilian life, but I find that not that humans are being desensitized, but that our moral fiber is being corroded by all this violence. Like we're becoming the animal, we're being death to Arabs. I think that's incredibly problematic. Okay, you know, we're not stabbing people, thank God. But the fact that we could even contemplate to say such a thing, I find really scary.
I think that it needs to be taken with a giant grain of salt, because the people who are saying that are 15-year-old boys who are full, like, they're very full of hormones, they have a lot of anger, and yes, they need to be reined in.
I don't know.
I'm just saying they need to be reined in, but I haven't seen anybody over the age of 16 in those groups, like, at all. Like, you don't see adults. So I'm just saying, it's part of like what they would be doing in a different country is drugs and clubbing. Yeah, is it acceptable? No, they need to be educated. But they're teens.
Football riots.
It's football riots. Like in England, they beat each other up after football.
Yeah,
they did great. No, but I don't think we need to own it as a society. We need to look at it and be like, you guys need to learn, and nobody gives these people weapons.
I totally hear that also. Like, I'm also thinking that, you know, these kids are just hormonal, and you know, they just like, they want to like outpunk the next kid, and they all like have this weird shaped heads and this whatever.
Hair.
You know, the hair and the weird faces and the weird faces, and it's like you're 12. It's like very weird. But at the same time, one could say, no, these are latent feelings that when they all grow up, they'll still have. That, I mean, is this a mom mentality, or is this a revealing, a feeling that they've been told to have by their parents or their society and stuff like that?
Especially, we know that it's even out of them, not just because most of these kids will go through the army, and in the army they will be told very clearly what the rules of engagement are.
Hmm.
Secondly, the use of guns in this country is practically zero when compared with other societies. So I think you answered that's the answer. They are just messing around, they are just jumping up and down and angry, and they're frustrated 15-year-olds, but they're not going to do anything with it.
And the leadership has to tell them, look, you can't say that. It's not acceptable.
Right.
It's not acceptable. And they have to be told by their leaders. There is a process. And, you know, not death to the Arabs. We'll have to fight the Arabs if we need to. So, it's education. You know, there's lots of latent things that people get left-wing in terms of homophobic and misogynist. You can get into a whole discussion as to what bad attitudes these 15-year-olds are going to grow up with. It's not just about this issue. And also, we can't get sidetracked into being stressing about the moral fibre of the nation that we don't take life seriously enough when we're not dealing with the issue of how people drive on the roads, which is probably more systematic in the country and more dangerous and just as bad in many ways. I'm not saying that we should distract attention from this by talking about driving, but I'm saying it is a holistic picture. We tend to very much stress about, what's happening to us, which stops us perhaps from dealing with it and dealing with other things that we need to deal with. I don't disagree with anything you said, but the leadership needs to give these guys directions, and the right-wing leadership needs to.
Yeah.
And I haven't been following it that carefully, but I hope the right-wing leadership is calling on its youth, because some of these youth are very uncontrollable. I'm not so worried about the 15-year-olds cruising up and down Ben Yehuda Street. I'm more worried about the 15-year-old sitting on a hilltop somewhere with very little hashgacha at all going on there. Because I know some of these guys, and I know the people who are trying to rein them in, and I know the difficulties that the vadim of the yeshuvim are having keeping any level of control over these guys who are living on hilltops.
What are they doing?
They're trying, they're talking about it, but people are doing different things. People are trying, because a lot of these guys are there because no one else wants them, and everyone has their own personal story, etc. And they're angry, and...
I lived in Ariel, I know these people.
No, I'm not suggesting that everybody's like that.
No,
not for me. I'm not. I'm saying.
Run amok, but I see there's a lot of stories that now.
You know something? I'm not talking about everybody. I'm talking about the few that are like that. The few that are like that need guidance as well. Need guidance. I'm not suggesting it's an endemic problem, but the whole, quote unquote, settler movement is full of this. God forbid, I'm not suggesting that. But there are people cruising around that need to have help.
There's been quite a lot of naivety going on around here, because it's not just a question of do we have to kill or not. It's actually also sometimes a question is do we have to, as people have said, become primitive, a bit barbaric, and actually lower ourselves to their level at times. The question is not just do we have to pull the trigger or not. The reality is that, this is why I say we're being a bit naive about it. The reality is that if you have to actually become, and sometimes the best way to ensure security is to scare the living hell out of our enemies.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean we're being barbaric. We can deal harshly with people and scare them if we feel that's necessary without becoming barbarous ourselves.
I mean, I've heard of people that will drop out of Shayetet or Makkal because they don't want to kill people. And the truth of the matter is, if you're in one of those units, you have to be prepared to slit someone's throat, and which is a step lower than shooting someone from a distance, which is a step. Lower than dropping a bomb from a drone, And aside from slitting someone's throat, it goes even deeper than that, and that's where the naivety comes in. So I think really, to come back to where we started, which is this golden air quote, I don't think she was really just talking about the regret that we have to kill their children. It's the regret, actually by extension, that we have to lower ourselves, that we have to become... Unfortunately, realistically, when we all feel it in to a different extent, but we have to, it's the sadness that we have to, the necessary...
Again, I don't know, because I've never been in the war scenario theatre, so I can't help. And there's no question that people have to become aggressive individuals in order to be able to do that. You can't just sort of run up a hill with a large machine gun in the same calm state that you sit in the salon and discuss, clearly not. But I don't know if that makes you into a monster. I don't know if that's the same as lynching people, and I don't know if that's the same as what we see going around.
I think your point about how when you're closer to the when you're closer to the actual killing, it's it seems different. It seems different, but it isn't really different. As you were saying about all the traffic deaths, you know, it's also a lot of deaths because of carelessness and lack of concern for human life. Look at regarding war having strategic considerations. The whole nuclear game. The nuclear game is saying that we're going to threaten to kill hundreds of thousands of completely innocent people in order to protect ourselves. And it's the threat of doing that, which is what the whole strategy is. And
right,
the whole strategy. Okay.
The strategy is a threat, whether we'd ever do it or not.
Well, so?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good
so
question.
It's just another step away.
Right.
In other words, are you a more civilized person if you threaten to kill, you know, 20,000 people? Or if you're willing to slip throat to one person? The other thing I wanted to mention is if we're putting, forgive me if I dozed off a little bit, you mentioned
it's fine.
But,
I didn't mention it.
Well, you don't know what I'm going to say. But, you know, we're piecing together from different elements in the halakha and the Tanakh an approach to these matters. There's something I'm not sure we mentioned, and that is Goel Hadam.
The Goel Hadam.
Goel Hadam.
The Goel Hadam is where the relative has a role in punishing a murderer, a murderer who murders with negligence.
Oh, that's like the Ari Mikla.
Yeah, when he's on the way to the Ari Mikla. But if you look at the Goel Hadam, Rabbi Sacks talks about this recently as well. The Goel Hadam is part of the justice procedure.
Right.
It's not just vengeance coming out of sort of blood feud. It's part of a justice process, meaning a Goel Hadam has very delineated roles. He can do this here, but not that there, and this here, and that there. It's very different. It's not coming from, if you just run up to somebody and kill them because they killed your relative, that's not called the Goel Hadam. So it's quite regulated. It just allows a person within a legal system, within the rule of law, to deal with somebody in an emotional way because of their family connection, etc., but to be the people who actually implement that. But it's very different.
But it utilizes, it integrates with
the
feeling
of
bloodlust.
Correct.
And of revenge.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
It's channeling in.
Correct. Well, there's a lot of channeling in halakha.
Okay, so, what I want to take out of that is, is the idea that to have a desire to deter and to take revenge and to even to do harm to people who are trying to do harm to you, who have just now done harm to someone that you care about, is something which is not reprehensible. It's something that the Torah takes in, integrates into a system of justice. It's something that has to be dealt with, but it's not something that
there is a Torah prohibition. There is a Torah prohibition of taking revenge,
okay,
unless it's done in very specific ways.
But I'm just saying how we look at the emotion and evaluate it. It's not clearly just something which is completely barbaric that we don't respect.
Right.
And
I think people want a little bit of food because I can see the kind of movement towards that. I didn't really try to answer any questions tonight, but what I do want to help you see is the range of sources available, where to learn more about it, and the kind of issues that come into play in these questions.
So basically the range is huge. I mean, it ranges from like, don't kill animals if we're all in the Trump image, to like, kill everybody, it's okay. Just
we saw anyone that says don't kill everybody, it's okay. The most extreme source that we saw in terms of license to kill, not about James Bond, was that it is legitimate to kill larger numbers of civilians as part of a military strike, even if that comes to defend a smaller number of your own. That's the most extreme we saw, actually, today.
And
there has to be a real military target, and there has to be a real need to strike it.
Okay.
So I don't think we saw sources that would justify killing innocent people without military, thinking. Yeah,
no.
I don't think we saw that. I just want to make that clear. All right.
Thank you.
Excuse me for my croaky voice, this is a lot better than it was yesterday. Wonderful.